Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If there's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland's listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. Today on our program, Larry Bolden reviews the 2018 novel by Willie Walton entitled Don't Skip Out on Me. Next Sunday at Portland's Art Museum's Witzel Auditorium, the sci-fi classic They Live will be showing at 7:30 p.m. Movie Mole's Fran Michelle and Joe Clement review the film as both a cleverly subversive and yet reactionary story about capitalism and its ideological deceptions. Time permitting, I'll conclude the program today with a reading by Pete Dolek entitled Capitalism's Triumph, Labor Rights Violated in Every Country on Earth. Leading off today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Alex Diamond on modern Colombian history, the elite-dominated state, the rise of FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and their growth to control large swaths of territory, the COCO, the economy, the paramilitaries, the peace process, potential outcomes. Bill?
Alex Diamond, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Alex Diamond is a millennial in his 30s. After college, he wandered the world in Asia, then Latin America, making a living teaching English. He wound up in Colombia and fell in love with the country that North Americans associate with COCO and the likes of Pablo Escobar. While wandering Colombia, going into the countryside, first on a bike and then on a motorcycle, and settling here and there to teach English, he began studying its history, especially its modern history, and then began writing about Colombia and its peoples. He's completely fluent in Spanish, especially writing about the struggles in the vast interior of Colombia. We talked to him. He's in Austin, Texas, now getting a PhD in sociology and Latin American studies and planning to go back to Colombia to teach. Alex, let's go right into your research, because the research you do, it illuminates modern Colombia and the many forces that are competing and the whole of the country in some ways. So tell us what the research that you're doing and the study of people.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah. So I do research. I assume many of the listeners are aware that a little less than 3 years ago, the Colombian government signed a peace agreement with the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, guerrillas, that ended a civil war that had taken place for more than a half century. So I do research on that agreement, but not from sort of top-down political perspective, but actually from the perspective of the communities that are most affected by the agreement. Communities that had heavy presence of the FARC guerrillas, in fact, where FARC guerrillas acted as the state for decades. So my research is on the transition in those communities based on FARC in particular, and what the peace process means for local life.
You say the FARC was, in fact, the sort of governing force, the unifying force over large amounts of Colombia's territory for quite a long time, for generations. The land, though, that area that they were sort of the governing force, it's mostly the tropical forests, very mountainous tropical forests, mostly in the interior. Give us a sense of sort of Colombia as a country, you know, and the various peoples that inhabit the various areas.
Well, so Colombia is a large and just beautiful country. It's split by three major mountain ranges, and large parts of the country are still very difficult to access. I mean, there are a lot of people, even places that are inhabited, that you can't access by roads. People use rivers or even little prop planes. So there's Amazon jungle, there's the Pacific coast that's very difficult to access. And you mentioned the history of colonialism there. It's a country whose boundaries were just sort of at the moment of independence from Spain, they were slapped on this large territory, but much of it was inaccessible. And there are many places where the former Colombian state didn't go and still doesn't go. So in that context, in areas where not the state has not just not gone, but has not invested in, the FARC guerrillas ended up controlling huge swaths of territory. I read that it's something similar to the size of El Salvador or Switzerland.
Yeah, and why did they form? What was happening in the politics of Colombia when the FARC formed? And why were they able to get so many recruits? And who are the people?
So the FARC have their roots in the rural poor. They were formed in 1964, and they were coming out of a period in Colombian history. And we talk about a 50-year civil war, 50-plus-year civil war.
Mm-hmm.
But the period before that was called La Violencia, which means the violence. So in 1948, Colombia has been always dominated by elites. It hasn't ever had sort of the history of the pink tide or leftist leadership that other countries in Latin America have. But the elites, which were traditionally the liberal and conservative parties, had a lot of competition. In 1948, there was a leader, Gaitán, who rose up sort of challenging that dominant elite hegemony. He had worked as a labor lawyer, supporting striking and, in fact, massacred banana workers in United Fruit Company plantations in northern Colombia. And the working class and rural poor really supported him. And he was assassinated in 1948, which set off a period of, this was La Violencia, 10 years of violence. And a lot of that violence broke down along partisan lines between liberal and conservative party. But at the same time, you see the Communist Party organizing self-defense groups in the countryside, particularly in those rural areas. And these crystallized. In 1958, there was an agreement between the elites that's called the National Front, where the liberal and conservative parties basically said, let's stop fighting. We'll alternate power. So they decided to just alternate the presidency, which happened until 1974, which ensured the continuing exclusion of the poor, but ended the fighting. And these Communist self-defense groups that had developed ended up settling in the center of the country, and they built these self-sustaining republics beginning in like the early 60s, one of which was called Marquetalia. And to put it in sort of historical context, 1959 is the Cuban Revolution, and as you mentioned, you have a power to the north, the United States, who's very interested in maintaining control in Latin America and do not like this model of communist self-sustaining peasant republics. So they encourage the Colombian government to attack them. They actually provide a lot of military and financial support, including the first use of napalm. They're trying out napalm in jungles to attack communist republics before they did it in Vietnam. And they attack this republic, Marquetalia, which had, I think, 44 armed men, with thousands of troops. And the campesino soldiers flee, and they hide in the jungle, and this is when they form the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. And for years, it's a very small group, and what they did is they protected the rural poor from advances of major, they're called latifundistas, major landholders. Colombian elites who wanted to increase their landholding, especially for cattle farming. That was sort of the history of the FARC and its founding.
This is Cable Radio, Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Alex Diamond. We're discussing basically the modern history of Colombia. We'll get to how it became the sort of the capital of coca, cocaine, and in fact, how did that? Tell us about the expansion of the FARC in the 80s and 90s, I guess, or the 70s, 80s, 90s, and continuing. It became a powerful military force and also a civilian government in many areas. How did that happen?
With Colombian economic planning, which was called accelerated economic development, the plan was to take land over from smallholding peasants The idea was these peasants would then go into rural areas and become, would go into urban areas and become an urban proletariat and work in factories. But many of them did not. What they ended up doing was, if they were successfully pushed off the land, they colonized ever more remote areas. So the country had huge, and still in fact has huge amounts of jungle, though now with the peace agreement you see a lot of deforestation happening, which is something we can talk about if you want. But the FARC ended up protecting the interests of these campesinos, they're called colonos, and end up just with this huge territory in rural Colombia. They expand in the 80s, they target areas, they start thinking more about taking central state power, and in particular thinking about how to fund their rebellion, and they start targeting areas with mining, with oil, where they can charge rents to elites, where they can get money. You also see them doing some kidnapping of elites at that time. So that drove the expansion, and in fact, where I do research in northern Colombia, they entered in 1981 as part of this expansion.
Tell us then about how then we have the state within a state that has considerable power and wealth, partly by, in fact, taxing those capitalist industries that happen to have penetrated their area, or I suppose some of the landowners have to cooperate with them, and they're taxed. And like all states, they tax at the point of the gun. If you don't pay your taxes, you go to jail, or worse.
That's right.
So they have the state within the state. How did then coca come into the picture?
Well, coca was not grown in Colombia. It was taken from Peru. This is how Pablo Escobar started, in fact, was bringing the leaves to be processed in Colombia and brought into the U.S. And it was actually crackdowns on coca growing in Peru and Bolivia that led them to start growing it in Colombia. And it spread very quickly because it's lucrative, because there's such a market in the U.S. because it's so expensive. So the FARC actually historically at first opposed coca, and then they started taxing it. They started getting involved. There's some disagreement about how much drug trafficking, particularly internationally, they were doing. But they were definitely involved in production and also, at least in Colombia, the trade. And this was another thing that helped them grow because it just led to a lot of money for them.
Yeah, and the farmers, of course, in those areas, the people with small holdings that were sort of working the farms in the forests, they chose coca to do because these areas were so inaccessible. In the peace process, in fact, they got promises that there would be transportation and some development so that they could, in fact, ship their vegetables and everything else across the country and make a living. But in the early days, really, coca was the one crop that they could refine very close to their, right in the fields. And it gets to be a small enough amount so that you can take it to market on mules or whatever it would be.
It's a great point. The people, and where I do research, which until a little more than 2 years ago was an economy that was dominated more than 90% by coca cultivation, there are not great alternatives. It simply costs, in many cases, more to take their crops out to places where they can sell them. That cost, the freight charge, is more than they're actually paid for crops in many cases. So for large parts of Colombia, in fact, it was coca cultivation was sort of the only thing that stopped the general worldwide trend of rural to urban migration.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick talking to Alex Diamond, who's lived in and studied and interviewed people. We've been talking about the growth of the FARC in the rural areas, why that happened, basically protecting the campesinos against people confiscating their land. Ultimately, the army, supported by the U.S., got a lot more successful, had a lot more equipment, and was doing a whole lot better. Well, what happened then? What happened to the FARC during?
Well, it's important, I think, to talk about another actor, which is in the 80s, you see the growth of paramilitary groups.
Right.
which defend the interests of wealthy landowners who are being extorted and kidnapped by the FARC. And these paramilitary groups are also crucial. They end up controlling the coca trade as well, doing in fact participating more in it than the FARC themselves. And these factors sort of join together. I don't want to be too romantic about the FARC either. They end up in a very violent confrontation, even more than when they were fighting the Colombian military. And this is an ongoing debate, but I believe they lose a lot of their ideological basis, particularly in areas where there's heavy fighting, and they become more concerned, in particular areas at least, with fighting paramilitaries and gaining control over the drug trade, securing the resource base. So you see that beginning to happen in the 1980s and 90s. In 2002, Alvaro Uribe, who's currently actually on trial by Colombia's constitutional court for witness tampering, but he was president from 2002 to 2010, he takes power and he goes after the FARC. And he's supported by Plan Colombia, which is a significant billions of dollars of U.S. financing that doubles the budget of the Colombian military. A lot of that money actually ends up in paramilitary hands as well, and leads to the military weakening of the group.
The military weakening of the FARC.
Right.
How did the peace process then develop?
So Alvaro Uribe finishes his terms, and his defense minister, in fact, takes over in 2010 and begins negotiating with the FARC, which is something that many people in Colombia were opposed to. But they end up signing a peace agreement in 2016 that negotiates the FARC disarmament, but it also negotiates, and this is what my research focuses on, it negotiates a significant investment in the rural communities where poverty and inequality were the major driving forces behind conflict. So it negotiates infrastructural development and investment, and it also negotiates a coca substitution program that recognizes coca's role in driving the conflict and tries to give poor cocaleros, the campesinos who were growing coca, aid as they tried to transition to legal crops.
This is Bill Resnick for The Old Mole talking to Alex Diamond, who's studying the peace process, the quote peace process between the FARC. It was a long, long, long-term struggle between the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, and the paramilitaries and the National Army, all financed by the U.S. The FARC was weakened. A peace process was developed. What's happened? That's your research. What happened after the peace process? Well, why don't you talk about that?
Well, a few things have happened. So my research is actually in the place where it focuses on the parts of the peace accords that were meant to drive rural development and coca substitution. And my research is in the village where the coca substitution program was launched, the pilot program. And what we've seen is that the government has absolutely failed to live up to the agreement. That's true for the first year plus that President Santos, Juan Manuel Santos, who negotiated the peace accords and actually won a Nobel Peace Prize. That's true for the time that he was still in power. And then a little more than a year ago, Iván Duque, who was pushed as the candidate of Álvaro Uribe, who I previously mentioned, and in the campaign promised to dismantle the peace process. He won the election and took power, and now has been doing seemingly everything he can to destroy the peace agreement. What that's meant in Briceño, where I do research, for example, is that people pulled out all their coca, so there's no longer coca, there's very little there, expecting these productive projects that were going to come in and give them goods to help them transition to illicit agriculture. And those projects haven't arrived, so the economy has collapsed entirely. Another thing that's also happened in Briceño and is happening on a national level is you see FARC guerrillas who participated in the peace process and some who never did, but mostly those who did, have formed what are called FARC dissident groups that have been growing. There was just a major video announcement a few weeks ago from Iván Márquez, who is going to be a senator as part of the peace agreement representing the FARC as a political party now. He's pulled out, and they've said, no, the government hasn't lived up to this agreement, so we're going back to arms. So across the country, I think now there are 29 fronts, groups of these dissidents in different communities in Colombia's rural areas. So this is a really disturbing development. And then the other thing I would say that's happened that my research really focuses on is the peace agreement has opened up space for all kinds of extractivist projects, places where the guerrillas, for example, to talk about where I do research, did not allow a Canadian company that wanted to, in fact, had the legal right to open a gold mine there. They were unable to do that while the FARC were there. And with the peace agreement, you're seeing all these increased extractivist projects, like gold mines. There's been intense deforestation in areas where the FARC previously had control and didn't permit that. So you've seen sort of this new regime of dispossession and accumulation that has been opened by the peace process as well.
What do you see as the future of Colombia now that the peace process seems to have broken down and the FARC is reforming and the I guess the military and the paramilitaries are probably reforming. In fact, they never disbanded. They probably just became part of the state military, a lot of them. What's the future of Colombia, and particularly what we haven't talked about, which it seems to me is looming over Colombia, is climate change. Like Bogota is way up one of the mountains, right? And it was fed by a glacier. I believe they're going to run out of water very, very soon because the glacier is almost melted. Yeah, there's no question that the glacier is going to give out in 5 or 10 years, I believe. What's the future of Colombia then? How do you see things? Is there any hope for the creation of a decent society, or are they just moving in neoliberal directions and putting in gold mines and, you know, all of the destructive things to do? A gold mine is way on top. Or putting in cattle ranches and destroying the forests, somewhat like Brazil is doing. What do you see as the... Is there any way out of that trajectory?
Well, I think the peace process for many people in Colombia a time, or at least had the potential for produce this great hope that, you know, all this violence, these many, many decades of violence, would end, and the country would do something to address particularly rural, though there's definitely urban inequality as well, but rural inequality and poverty that's driven the conflict. So far, the early returns are not promising, but there are a lot of people, and there are still many people within the FARC who are defending the peace process, right? It isn't the entire armed group that has abandoned it. In the last election, a leftist candidate, Gustavo Petro, went further than had ever happened in Colombia. So the sort of traditional elite sources of power are maybe weakened a little bit. I think there is some reason to be optimistic about attitudes among the youth, people who are looking for a different vision. Aside from that, I think economically the direction the country is going is not particularly promising. Large parts of Colombia, and in fact, coca, like as you pointed to, was so important and is so important for rural economies that it's kind of been the one thing that stopped rural to urban migration, or at least slowed it down. It's still happening. But I worry, and based on where I do research, I worry that there's these huge populations of rural poor who are just getting in the way at this moment of mega projects, whether it's hydroelectric dams, gold mines, African palm plantations is a major issue, cattle ranching. And these people are repeatedly and more being pushed out of their homes, I mean, Colombia already has an internal refugee population, I think of 7 million people. But they're pushed into cities and into urban peripheries where there just aren't jobs and places that are very insecure. So from violence to violence. And that, I think this is also a global phenomenon, but these sort of surplus people who don't fit in particularly well anywhere in the economy, and the places where they are increasingly valuable to global capital. I think in Colombia, my fear is that that translates to violence. That translates to competition over those resources, which takes the form of violence. And as we're seeing now, that leads to sort of a rebirth, a regrowth of leftist guerrilla groups who, to some extent, are defending local people and to some extent are defending their own interests and power. So I guess in general, I don't feel very optimistic, but I think this is still a moment with the peace agreement where there are people fighting and where there's the potential to fight in Colombia for a different vision for the future.
Alex Diamond, before we sign off, how do people access your writings?
The most recent thing I published was in NACLA, N-A-C-L-A, and it's a piece on the potential for a gold mine and the history of a hydroelectric dam in Briceño and the peace process there and what those mega projects have to do with both violence and peace. So maybe you can link to that on the Old Mole Facebook page, but if you just search for NACLA
Report Project on the Americas is I think the title of their sort of publication.
Yeah, will mega projects destroy Colombia's peace process?
Uh-huh.
Or with my name, Alex Diamond.
Alex Diamond, wonderful talking to you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Bill. It was my pleasure.
Salió a bailar,
hey,
una danza peligrosa. ¿Y dónde que se va a bailar?
¿Dónde?
En la mina La Golosa. A ese baile no voy yo, porque así nadie la goza si la bailas tú o yo.
¿Por qué?
Nos vamos pa' lo yo.
Peligrosa La Golosa, somos la tierra. Mi tierra hermosa, maravillosa, somos la tierra.
The song was Somos la Tierra, or We Are the Earth, by Colombian group Sistema Solar. It comes out of a struggle against La Colosa mine in central Colombia. The lyrics discuss the dangers the mine posed to local livelihoods and the environment, and the need to resist it. Following local mobilization, the mining project was defeated by a 98% vote against it in a local referendum in 2017. A legal mechanism Colombia's constitutional court has since eliminated. This is KBOO Portland, and you're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. Now, Larry Bolden reviews Don't Skip Out on Me, a 2018 novel by Willie Lawton. Ostensibly, the novel is about boxing and sheep herding, but can be seen as a simple tale of honor and how it shines even in the muck.
Good morning. I want to talk to you this morning about a book that simply fell in my lap, loaned me by a reader friend. The book, Don't Skip Out on Me, by Willie Lawton, is not one I would have picked up on my own. For one thing, it's a book about a boxer, and I don't care for boxing. It is also one that is written in simple, almost flat prose, and I tend to favor books by accomplished word weavers. But this short little novel grabbed me and would not let go. I finished it in the Salt Lake City airport with tears streaming down my cheeks and surrounded by passengers waiting for a New York City flight. I was not ashamed of the tears. The author had somehow so transported me that I felt as if all those around me were also finishing the book and so would understand. Horace Hopper is a young man, half Paiute, half Irish, whose Native American father abandoned him and whose very ill mother could not really take care of him. Lucky for Horace, he spends most of his young life on a sheep ranch owned by Mr. and Mrs. Reese, who love him like a son and fully intend to leave the ranch to Horace. But Horace, ashamed of his mixed heritage, decides he must prove himself in the world, and he decides the way to do this is by becoming champion of the world in his weight class. He's read many times a self-help book that challenges the reader to build his boat one brick at a time, strange metaphor, and to devote everything to becoming champion. Although Horace is very close to the Reeses, whom he always addresses as Mr. and Mrs. Reese, he tells them he must leave the ranch in order to pursue his dream. While Mr. Reed pleads with him not to leave, and Horace is well aware that Mr. Reese will not be able to maintain his 1,200-head sheep ranch much longer without Horace, who has been his right-hand man for many years, still he feels honor-bound to make it on his own. Horace is convinced that Mexican boxers are the best and the toughest in the world, so when he leaves the Nevada ranch and travels to Tucson, he changes his appearance and his name. He becomes Hector Hidalgo and tries to learn Spanish and tries to like Mexican food, though it's too spicy for him. Hector manages to find a trainer who will train him for a price, and he soon gets a Golden Gloves amateur fight. Mr. Reese is offered to drive Horace, a.k.a. Hector, to Arizona, but the boy says, quote, that there were certain times when you had to do things alone, close quote. Mrs. Reese asks her husband why Horace needs to be a boxer. Quoting again from the book, "I'm not sure," he whispered. "I've thought about it over and over, and I'm just not sure. But remember, he's young, and a lot of young men want to prove themselves." Close quote. It turns out that Hector's an incredibly hard hitter, but not really a boxer. So from his very first fight, he takes a lot of punishment. Diego, his trainer, tells him, "You hit as hard as any kid I've seen in a long, long time. You walk into punches, but man, oh man, do you have power." Close quote. While he wins his early bouts, he's very badly beaten in almost every one. While the descriptions of the fights are grisly, they are well done, and soon the reader becomes used to the fact that in almost every fight, Hector's nose is rebroken, and eventually it will just not stop bleeding. In addition, his retina is detached in one fight, and a doctor tells him he should not fight again, and that if he does, he risks losing sight in one or both eyes. While I've concentrated so far on Horace's life as a fighter, I think this book is really about honor. In his dealings with women, with managers, with poor folks he simply meets on the street, Horace is utterly honorable. He gives away his money simply because he sees others that need it more. Mr. Reese has taught him that the important thing in life is to be honorable and truthful, and Horace is both almost to a fault. On the book cover, one critic says, quote, "No one anywhere writes as beautifully about people whose stories stay close to the dirt. Willie Vluten is a secular and thus real and profoundly useful saint." Ah, yes, the simplicity, the simple elegance of Vluten's prose carries the story along. I intend to read all that he has written. When it becomes obvious that Horace will not become champion of the world and really can't fight anymore, he knows he can go back to the Reeses and the ranch. He knows they want him to come home, and in most ways he wants to go home. Quoting from the book, "When he got back to his room each evening, he crawled into bed paralyzed with anxiety and shame. Why did he have to tell Mr. Reese everything? Why couldn't he have just kept to himself that he wanted to be Mexican and wanted to be a world champion boxer? The nights crawled by. Hours seemed like days. He would get lost in thoughts of Mr. and Mrs. Reese, the ranch, and the horses and the dogs. And when he did, his stomach would give out, and he would feel like he was falling. He wanted more than anything to go back to them, to be of comfort to them, but always something inside forced him not to." Close quote. Will Hector Delgado revert to Horace Hopper, and will Mr. Reese finally find him and take him home? The answer to this question will require you to read the book. It's a wonderful little book, and you'll be glad you read it. I feel I really learned something about honor and truthfulness. I've been talking about Willie Vluten's 2018 novel, Don't Skip Out on Me. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
Thank you, Larry. And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. Next up, Fran Michelle and Joe Clement review the sci-fi classic They Live, which will be playing at the Witzel Auditorium at the Portland Art Museum this coming Sunday, October 13th, at 7:30 p.m. They call out the film as both subversive and reactionary.
Good morning. This is Fran Michelle here with Joe Clement to discuss They Live, the 1988 cult classic directed by John Carpenter. The film's main character is an economic migrant played by wrestler Roddy Piper, listed in the credits as Nada. He discovers and later compels his itinerant co-worker Frank, played by Keith David, to also see that many of the wealthy and powerful people around them are actually ghoulish extraterrestrials who can only be recognized through special sunglasses, which also reveal that advertisements, magazines, and store signs actually say things like obey and consume and marry and reproduce. Dollar bills bear the message, this is your God. Most of the population is either blinded by TV signals or else consciously collaborating with the alien free enterprisers who view the Earth as just another developing planet, their third world. The small opposition movement have produced the demystifying sunglasses and have been trying to hack into the television signal that blinds people to the black and white reality of their world. They operate out of a church across from the shanty town where Nada and Frank stay. In a scene reminiscent of recent events, police in riot gear use bulldozers to clear the shantytown. When the ghouls realize the protagonist can see them as they are, they send police and alien technology in pursuit, and he flees, shooting aliens and sparing humans, blasts his way through a bank, carjacks the affluent Holly, played by Meg Foster, and makes his way to the source of the brainwashing TV transmitter to destroy it. So, Joe, we find this film has some pros and some cons. What do we like about it? What's worth seeing?
Well, I think that right off the bat, they do a good job suggesting that the social dislocation that the Nada character is experiencing and that all the, or most of the homeless people and the working poor are the result of broad social forces and not really related to anything in their character. And you see the Nada character early on go into some Department of Human Services office or employment office looking for work. And when he tells the social worker there that he had worked for 10 years in Denver and things just dried up, she rolls her eyes at him as if he's, you know, making up an excuse for his own ineptness.
And he comments that, you know, we made all sorts of concessions to the bosses, but then they just gave themselves raises. So it certainly echoes elements that people are increasingly aware of in current economic circumstances. And it does give us this perspective of the homeless. And Nada walks into L.A. Nobody ever says it's L.A., but that is apparently, I mean, that's where it was filmed. But it's really this on-foot perspective that one doesn't generally get of that city. And we really see this, you know, the shanty town, Justiceville, where the homeless are living. And we have a sense of the sort of broad base of economic distress.
I really liked how the shanty town, which you mentioned, is called Justiceville, is much more than a collection of hovels that random poor people had built up for themselves. But it is a collective. It is a purposive sort of organization, even in connection with the church, which is just across the street. They offer meals to everyone, and there is a certain sense of camaraderie. When Nada shows up on the site with Frank, the, I guess, leader asks him what's in his bag or those tools, and he says, if he can use them, we can use you. And he seems to acquiesce to that, and there's just this sense that people know how to take care of one another, and that when given the chance, they will.
Yeah, and the resistance movement is really grassroots, and against that, the police are really militarized. I mean, when that shantytown is destroyed by the bulldozers coming in, it really resonates today with scenes of the destruction of occupations.
I noticed that the resistance movement is grassroots as well. There is an, I guess, token professor or academic, which is the sort of place that a lot of party politics have come from in the past. But here we seem to have pretty regular people. They're probably displaced middle-class people, but lots of working poor people. A lot of the people here have jobs. They just don't have a place to stay. The Frank Armitage character is actually from Detroit. He had worked in the steel mills, and I guess there's better work in L.A. than there is anywhere closer to Detroit. But yeah, the militarization of the police is, you know, both obvious and just kind of the brutality and excess of it. And yet we don't really notice any soldiers in this movie operating as part of this global domination until kind of towards the end, when there are soldier-looking security guards inside of a special alien facility. But then you find out that a lot of the police are being tricked into this over-response by the thought of there being a communist plot. This is still 1988. The Soviet Union had not quite fallen, but there was still some of those fears.
Yeah, these are, if it had been made today, they would have been told they were terrorists. Part of what's so appealing about this film is the very simplicity with which it sort of unveils and shows us the kind of ideological manipulation that is that's certainly going on, and the sense that, you know, the rich really are different and kind of ghoulish and horrible. That, you know, I mean, the 80s, it was the notion that yuppies are really aliens. And there's something sort of emotionally gratifying about, at one point, Nada says, when he puts on the glasses and looks at a television image of a politician speaking, it figures it would be something like this. It's a sort of literalization of a kind of gut feeling that I think a lot of people have about the alienness of the 1%.
Yeah, it also has a long history in the responses to systems of domination and the experience of systemic exploitation. If you go back to the Nazi ideology and just the role that the cosmopolitan Jew and the Jewish plot played into how they felt they needed to respond to what was wrong with the world, the Depression in the 1930s, that you see that this is playing in some kind of uncomfortable territory when you think of what that kind of thinking can help justify.
Yeah, I mean, the very sort of appeal of it, I think, is tied up with what's really problematic about the film in the way that it does suggest that you know, these problems, the problems that we have with environmental destruction and with economic dislocation, that these are things that are alien in some way rather than being something that is coming from quite human society and from human modes of production and the way that we have ourselves arranged our world. So it simplifies things in a way that is sort of emotionally gratifying and yet deeply problematic if we try to take it seriously as an analysis of what the problems that we're facing really are.
Right, like you see all the messages about obey, reproduce, and marry, and yet there is a definite sort of ideological world being captured in the Frank Armitage's character, his response to being and getting involved in this resistance movement and wanting to pretend that nothing is wrong, or, you know, cynically recognizing something is wrong, but that he should just stay out of it and mind his own business. That's the sort of level of ideology which I think more viscerally grips us and yet which is clearly much harder to capture in a bullet point.
Yeah, I mean, one of the more ridiculous scenes in the film is this 6-minute fight that Nada and Frank have when Nada is trying to get Frank to put on the glasses and look through them, and Frank really doesn't want to. And there are various ways to read that, including Frank's resistance to facing the circumstances of his life.
And then there's the Nada character himself, who is this really kind of folksy American who is very naive, who, you know, says that he believes in America and that if you play by the rules that things will play out for you. And he even says at one point that everybody seems to be having their own hard times right now, really kind of still individualizing the systemic issues that are otherwise, you know, pretty well portrayed in the movie. And I think that by the end, when he dies, there's an interesting reversal in the fact that all of the alien unveiled images are in black and white, and just the very idea of there being an alien plot itself is a black and white way of looking at the systemic issues. And yet when he blows up their transmitter and he dies, everything else comes into full color, and it's a lot more complicated.
He's not the brightest tool in the shed. The kind of solution that he offers the second half of the movie is this action film where he is running around shooting people, or shooting aliens, mostly shooting aliens. And there are very few problems in life that can actually be solved by that. Unfortunately, we cannot end capitalism by knocking out a single TV transmitter. And in the course of doing that, it turns out that he's been also betrayed by the femme fatale played by Meg Foster. I mean, most of the ghouls who Nada has scathing comments about and revulsion about the appearance of are female. So there is a kind of level of misogyny involved in the film as well.
There's also a bit of bleeding over when it comes to who is really captured by these aliens. Most of the people are the rich or the already powerful. There's not really a much sense of kind of the historical transition between when this started and when we got to where we are. But there is a really interesting character who originally is one of the homeless people in the shanty town who then gets captured. He eventually makes this really kind of uncompelling argument about how we all sell out.
Yeah, the drifter who goes from homeless to a sellout on what he sees as the winning side is, like Nada, our hero, a white guy. And Jonathan Lethem, in his monograph on this film, points out that none of the aliens are black. I mean, there is the black sidekick, and there are some odd moments with Latino construction workers on the construction site, but it's quite clear that the wealthy are the white, the aliens are the affluent, and the people in positions of power, politicians, police. And so although the film has a kind of oppositional consciousness in its recognition of the disproportionate whiteness and the class dimension of oppression, it also is fairly conventional in its action film heroism of the violent white man, and leaving aside questions of really interrogating racial and sexual oppressions in the context of offering that action hero solution.
Yeah, if you pay attention to a lot of the ideological messages that are compelling people to do things, it's really aimed at already middle-class consumers, probably white ones, and there's nothing really compelling people to... There's nothing compelling people to racial injustice, to commit acts of racial injustice, and yet that's an avowed problem that the professor in one of his rants mentions, that there is no racial justice, and it's hard to see where those people's problems come in, and in a way, the movie is a bunch of first world problems.
So it's an overly simplistic and yet pleasing, cheesy, campy B-movie that has something to say about the dangers of consumer capitalism, although perhaps not as much as we'd like about how that fits into larger and more complicated structures of oppression or what we might really do about them.
Yeah, I think that if anything, the one thing to take away from the film is really kind of a negative way of looking at its portrayal of capitalism and of the way that we imagine there being a very definite group of people who pull the strings and who make it not work for everyone else. You can check this movie out for free from the Multnomah County Library. Movie Madness surely has a copy of it. But if you'd like to see it on the big screen, it's going to be playing on October 13th, so that's this next Sunday, 7:30 at the Portland Art Museum's Witzel Auditorium. You go to the Portland Art Museum in downtown Portland, and they have a movie theater there. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Joe Clement and Fran Michel reviewing the cult classic sci-fi thriller They Live.
They live, they walk, they lie, they love, they live, they walk, they lie, 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 they
The song was the main theme song of the film, also entitled They Live, by the Evil Nine. On the off chance you couldn't understand the lyrics, a typical stanza goes like this. They walk, they lie, they love, they live. They wake, they fall, they cry, they live. They fight, they fail, they die, they live. They hope, they try, they turn, they live. Don't forget, the film will be showing at Portland Art Museum's Wutzel Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. this coming Sunday, October 13th. Today I'm sharing with you an article entitled Capitalism's Triumph, Labor Rights Violated in Every Country on Earth by Pete Dolak. It rates all the world's countries in respect to the rights of labor. The U.S. does not fare well. Dolak begins, in what country are labor rights fully respected? The sad answer is none. Labor rights are routinely violated around the world, and the trend is only getting worse. The International Trade Union Federation has again issued its annual Global Rights Index, and the result is no better than in past years. It's worse. For example, the number of countries that exclude workers from the right to establish or join a union increased from 92 in 2018 to 107 in 2019. Even in Europe, the region with the relatively best conditions for working people, half the countries exclude at least some groups of workers from freely associating by allowing non-standard forms of work, such as zero-hour contracts, temp work, or misclassifying people working through online platforms as self-employed. Corporations ever on the lookout for ways to extract more from their workforce, and with government complicity, continue to press down. The Confederation, its report, said, quote, worldwide, new technology has allowed employers to use various mechanisms to avoid paying minimum entitlements and exclude workers from labor laws. Recent technological leaps in the ways that work can be allocated and assessed has resulted in increased incidences of workers being denied rights under the guise of flexibility and as platform workers. Decent work is being affected, and rights are being denied by companies avoiding rules and regulations. More and more governments are complicit in facilitating labor exploitation or allowing the rule of law to be avoided because workers are forced to work in the informal sector of the economy. End quote. Rapid advances in technology, because they are controlled by corporations and repressive governments, are enabling continued deterioration in working conditions. Not only does technology enable production to be moved to locations with ever lower wages and regulations, but enables the weakening labor protections in new high-tech wrapping. In its report, the International Trade Union Confederation ranks countries from 1 to 5, with 1 the least repressive and 5 the most. Only 12 countries, Austria, Denmark, Finland, Germany, Iceland, Ireland, Italy, the Netherlands, Norway, Slovakia, Sweden, and Uruguay, are ranked as 1. These are countries that are merely sporadic violators of rights, so there are no countries on earth that do not violate labor rights. The report's rankings are as follows. 1. Sporadic violations of rights, the 12 countries noted above. 2. Repeated violations of rights, 24 countries including France, Japan, and New Zealand. 3. Regular violations of rights, 26 countries including Austria, Canada, and Spain. 4. Systematic violation of rights, 39 countries including Argentina, Chile, and Mexico. And 5. No guarantee of rights, 34 countries, including Brazil, China, Greece, and India. Interestingly, the two countries most prone to wagging fingers at the rest of the world, Britain and the United States, once again fared poorly. Britain was ranked as a 3, representing a country that has regular violation of rights. The U.S. was rated as a 4, among countries determined to condone systematic violations of rights. There is nothing new here. The U.S. has consistently been scored as a 4 in these reports over the years. As recently as 2017, Britain was also ranked as a 4. In a country rated as a 4, the government and or companies are engaged in serious efforts to crush the collective voice of workers, putting fundamental rights under threat. So much for the so-called land of freedom. The Confederation, which described itself as a coalition of national trade union and centers encompassing 331 affiliated organizations in 163 countries and territories, determines its ratings by checking adherence to a list of 97 standards derived from International Labor Organization conventions. The methodology is grounded in standards of fundamental rights at work, in particular the right to freedom of association, the right to collective bargaining, and the right to strike, the Confederation wrote in their report. During the 6 years that the Confederation has issued its yearly reports, conditions have steadily deteriorated. Since the initial report in 2014, every region of the world has seen scores worsen. And this is thus it is no surprise that inequality is rising around the world. Unemployment is endemic and far higher than official government statistics would have us believe, and corporate tax dodging facilitated by government policies is widespread. The world's working people continue to be on the losing side of one of the most one-sided wars in human history. That was capitalism's triumph, labor rights violated in every country on earth, by Pete Dolak. Pete Dolak writes the Systemic Disorder blog and has been an activist with several groups. His book, It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment, is available from Zero Books. This article can be found on the Counterpunch webpage for October. What is to be done? Workers of the world, unite. And I have a correction here, just handed me. They Live will be showing at 2 p.m. this Sunday, October 13th, at the Whitzel Auditorium. And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Thanks to our participants today, Bill Resnick and Alex Diamond, for their discussion of Colombian history and politics. Larry Bolden for his review of the 2018 novel by Willie Walton entitled Don't Skip Out on Me, and to Fran Michel and Joe Clement for their review of the sci-fi classic They Live. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. We agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well can thrive and lead fulfilling lives with an ecologically sustainable environment. From the Moles' perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles that chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission.